Constitution work its way out. And the issue of impeachment itself is kind of the safety valve of a constitutional republic in which we have checks and balances by three different bodies. That's the Congress, the Supreme Court, and the White House, the executive, the legislative, and the judicial. And whenever this impeachment was included for when there would be an abuse of power by the president or other officials of the executive branch, that can be remedied in order to prevent the balances of power, the proper checks and balances of getting out of whack or becoming unbalanced or becoming dominated by one branch. And I think you make a very good argument. Again, we talk about this idea of an imperial presidency, that we have seen that happening for a long time, even before Donald Trump. But that said, impeachment is one of the most serious things that we have in the Constitution, sort of the ultimate act in this balance of, checks of one branch against another. And it's going to be deliberative, and it's going to take a long time to play out. And I think not only is Donald Trump on trial, but I very much think that Mitch McConnell and even Chuck Schumer and even the Senate itself is on trial, because this is something that ends up looking like a sham. People say, well, it's a sham, let's not pay any attention to it. I wouldn't argue that. I think we should pay attention to it to see if it is a sham, because if it is a sham, we should know it is a sham. And what happens, again, when Congress is called on to do some of, one of the most important duties that it has, and that would be impeaching a president if the facts require it to do so. And that is what this is about. For me, it's always been, what do things look like on the other end of this? Even more important than actually what happens in this very moment. So friends, we're hoping that you will support KPFA in its endeavor to be able to bring you broadcasts and historians and political and analysts and anyone else that we should have. We're even going to be taking phone calls during this trial. And in fact, maybe we should open it now. But before I do, look, you can't call to make a pledge because we don't have a phone room, but we do have a website. So again, just want to ask you to go to kpfa.org. Don't know how long this break is, inevitably going to last, but why don't we take a few phone calls? I'm going to give out the phone number. That is 1-800-958-9008. 1-800-958-9008. 9008. If you want to give us a call and weigh in on what you think about the Senate impeachment trial, give us a call quickly, because we won't probably have a lot of time, but we can probably squeeze a couple of callers in. So again, that number, 1-800-958-9008. 1-800-958-9008. And we'll get to these calls as soon as we can. Tomorrow, we expect the oral arguments to begin in earnest. Today, it is solely dedicated to the rules of what will, of how the trial will proceed. And so we will, tomorrow, we'll actually get to the substance of what the charges against President Donald Trump are. And again, they are abuse of power for using his office to try to force Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden, a political rival. That's the charge. Abuse of power, and also obstruction of justice. Or I'm sorry, not justice, of Congress. Obstruction of Congress, because the president, led by Pat Cipollone, which is interesting. This is the first time we've actually had the opportunity to hear from Pat Cipollone. We've only seen his letters before indicating that the White House was not going to participate whatsoever in the trial. And so now we actually get to hear from him. But because of that stand, that we're not going to provide witnesses, that we're not going to provide documents, that led to the second article of impeachment, which is obstruction of Congress. So as soon as I get word of who our first caller is, we will be able to do that. Again, you are listening to KPFA's live coverage of the Senate impeachment trial. When we come back, when the Senate comes back, they will be debating what is happening with Chuck Schumer's amendment. I'm Mitch Jezrich. I'll be your host. We'll have other hosts as well throughout these coming weeks as we cover the Senate trial. And just going to, do we have any callers yet? Where's, okay, just go ahead and tell me in my ear when we have one. And so once we get there, once the Senate comes back, we will have to go to it. So try to get through as many callers as we can. You can also hit me up on Twitter at Mitch Jezrich. You could find me on Twitter at Mitch Jezrich. That's a good way to also get me a question. MitchJezerich. MitchJezerich. That's how you spell my name. I'm going to take a quick musical break, and then when we come back, we will get to the calls. Again, you are listening to KPFA's live coverage of the Senate impeachment trial. We are going to go to callers now, and the first person on the line is Don B. Don B., good afternoon. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. Am I coming in clear?
Yes, I can hear you. What are your thoughts?
Okay, wonderful. It's simply that whether you support the argument of the Democrats or the Republicans, whether you think Trump deserves to be impeached, they know, both sides, Democrats and Republicans, what's going to happen. This has all been calculated. So basically, it's not a witch hunt necessarily as much as it is now a parade by the Democratic Party. They have to be careful about how they're spending their time pushing for impeachment when they know it's not going to happen. They're simply trying to damage Trump's chances of being reelected, which fine for a strategy, but it's basically it's an indirect argument. They're trying to push for impeachment when they know it's not going to happen. The Senate's never going to complete it. So why would they keep pushing for it simply to damage Trump's position in the 2020 election?
What if they believe that Trump has done, that the proper – I don't disagree with what you're saying, and I do agree that it's very unlikely that they're going to actually remove Donald Trump from office. But if you think that Donald Trump has done an act that warrants impeachment, then if impeachment's not the right thing to do, what is?
No, it's not that impeachment is not the right thing to do. They know through the existing legal process that it's in the hands of the Republican Senate that it's simply not going to happen. It's all been calculated out. The Republicans are going to sit out and wait out the clock, just like they did with the justice nominations in the Obama administration, and wait out the clock until it's their turn. In this case, they're going to wait out the clock until go through whatever necessary process they need to create a charade that there is a legal process happening, and then, in fact, at the end, not impeach Donald Trump. It's not going to happen. The Democrats have already calculated this. They already know this, but they're going to make as much of a grandstand parade out of this process that they're pushing for impeachment. They believe impeachment should happen to get into the moral support of their own party that they're fighting hard for them. But in fact, they're wasting our tax dollars not doing other processes that they know are not as wasteful. Like,
do you not think there might be some individuals who still kind of identify themselves as Republicans that may, not have, gone all in on Trump that could be persuaded through this process?
I think there's too much pressure and party pressure to go against the grain that way. If they do, the only way that'll happen is if there's such a public exposure of, say, like through the witnesses that they're trying to get pulled up. It's not, and that's not going to happen either. But without any real public exposure or scrutiny of the real details, the facts that would demand impeachment, there's no way any sane person would not impeach the president. It's not going to happen because there is too much of a culture of of following the leader, and they're not going to go against the grain, against their own party, because that would be their own career, the death of their own career.
All right, Don, thank you for your call. Appreciate that. We're next going to go to Vicente. Vicente, good afternoon. You're on the air.
Oh, my mic still too hot?
No, you sound just perfect, sir.
Okay, good. I would piggyback on what the last caller said. I also agree. I think there's enough evidence to impeach. I would like to give another side that I feel that globally, I think it's more important to elect him out. In my circles of East Oakland, when you talk to people, what it kind of said to us when he first got elected was that it really shined a light on the fact that, look, half of our country is still prejudiced, racist, sexist, homophobic. So I think it's really important that we vote him out to show the rest of the world there's more of us that are more open-minded and, you know, I don't care what you're doing in your house. It's none of my business as long as it doesn't affect other communities. Again, I just think it's important for us to elect him out globally to show that as a country, we're not that pedophiles and Epstein and all of those different things. So that's my side of it. I'd love to hear what other people think as well.
All right, Vicente, appreciate your call. I guess calling from Oakland. We're now going to go. And again, folks, if you want to get in on this, the phone number is 1-800-958-9008, 1-800-958-9008. Again, we are in a break. When the Senate comes back, they will be voting on Chuck Schumer's second resolution. We go to Lucy from Santa Rosa. Good afternoon, Lucy. You're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon, Mighty Mitch. I just want to say I think Mitch, D.C. Mitch, is unqualified to be heading this whole deal, since he said right at the onset, not this onset, but when we were talking about it coming over to the Senate, that he was going to coordinate his efforts completely with the president. Is that fair? I mean, does the judge say that when he walked into court?
No, you're correct on that. Of course, the thing we have to keep in mind is that according to the Constitution, the Senate shall have sole responsibility or sole power to conduct the impeachment trial. And so you're right. These senators all take an oath, and they take the oath. And part of the oath is of impartiality. Doesn't mean they will be impartial. Doesn't mean that they even already have signaled that they wouldn't be. Interestingly, Lucy, is there is a thought out there that what the Democrats should do is bring a motion and ask John Roberts to make a motion that Mitch McConnell and other members who have already said how they view this trial should be excused from the trial because they broke their impartiality oath. If John Roberts were to act on that, and I don't think he would, but if he was, then the Republicans and the Senate as a whole could overturn what John Roberts would do with a vote.
Well, I think that's a good idea. I think it's an excellent idea, and I hope it's, you know, maybe.
I mean, they won't get Mitch McConnell out of the trial, but what you would do by doing that is force a debate on it and just bring to light that you have members who have already indicated what they're doing in this trial.
But the other thing I want to bring up is that Mitch McConnell has been sitting on, I don't know how many bills, but the most prominent bill is the gun control bill. And why does he do that? I mean, I feel every time we have a mass killing in our country, we've had 404, I learned on KPFA. That's more than days in the year, as KPFA pointed out. He's totally unqualified to be any kind of leader anywhere. Because every time we have one of those mass murders, he's like pulling the trigger.
Well, he's not gonna move on the legislation, and you're right about. And you know, the thing is when it comes to legislation, the Senate has not accomplished a lot during the Trump years under McConnell, except they have confirmed more judges than at any other time in the history of the Senate. And, you know, they lowered the rules and then the bars and took away the filibusters. But not the Republicans alone. Democrats started the process back in 2013. Lucy, appreciate your call. Thank you for that. We're now going to go to Muhammad in San Jose. Muhammad, good afternoon. You are on the air.
Yes, good afternoon.
You're on the air, Mohammed.
Yes. Okay, so I have a little comment and also a statement. I mean, a question.
Good.
Okay, so my comment here, first of all, is the way the thing is, this setup, this Senate court is set up, is just like Shakespeare, Merchant of Venice.
The Merchant of Venice.
Merchant of Venice, Shakespeare.
Yeah, gotcha.
Merchant of Venice. Okay?
Yeah.
I think, like, all the Republicans are like the Gentiles. Then the Democrats act like Shylock, the Jewish merchant. So they gave him all the chance, but who the Democrats have been waiting all this time, collecting all the information, just like Shylock. Antonio had to pay him money. He has all the rights, show all the proof. But then they say, okay, yeah, you are right. But then, you know, you have to cut the pound of flesh, just exactly 1 pound. It has to be exactly 1 pound, not less, not more. And there is no, in the contract, there was no blood to drip. So this is the same thing. I am, you know, I came from Africa, West Africa, and I've been here for quite some time. And I think, you see, this place is just theoretically, they seem to be very okay. They sound okay, but in practice, it's very corrupt. So this kind of thing, I'm saying, it's just a waste of time. Because if they are not going to go anywhere, just like the other guy said, it's a waste of time. When we know that they are not going to, you know, they are not going to do anything with him. With all the evidences and et cetera, et cetera.
Mohammed, I'm going to have to stop you there. It looks like the Senate might be coming, or, well, maybe not. Mohammed, you have a question? You said you had a question. Let's see if we can get that in quickly.
So where are we going to go from here? If they are just wasting time, what do you think is going to happen?
We'll have to take that up. I appreciate your call, Mohammed, and Carlos and John and Steve. We'll try to get to you next time. The Senate is back in session.
Okay, Mr. Schiff, you have an hour, and we'll be able to reserve time for rebuttal.
And they are going to debate the Second Amendment that has been brought by Charles Schumer. And this is Val Demings, a Democrat from Florida,
Chief Justice
who
Roberts,
is a part of the floor management team.
Counsel for the White House. I am Val Demings from the state of Florida. The House managers strongly support the amendment to issue subpoena for documents to the State Department. As we explain, the first article of impeachment charges the president with using the power of his office to solicit and pressure Ukraine to announce investigations that everyone in this chamber knows to be bogus. The president didn't even care if an investigation was actually conducted, just that it was announced. Why? Because this was for his own personal and political benefit. The first article further charges that the president did so with corrupt motives and that his use of power for personal gain harmed the national security of the United States. As the second article of impeachment charges, the president sought to conceal evidence of this conduct. He did so by ordering his entire administration, every office, every agency, every official, to defy every subpoena served in the House impeachment inquiry. No president in history has ever done anything like this. Many presidents have expressly acknowledged that they couldn't do anything like this. President Trump did not take these extreme steps to hide evidence of his innocence or to protect the institution of the presidency as a career law enforcement officer. I have never seen anyone take such extreme steps to hide evidence allegedly proving his innocence. And I do not find that here today. The president is engaged in this cover-up because he is guilty, and he knows it. And he knows that the evidence he is concealing will only further demonstrate his culpability. Notwithstanding this effort to stonewall our inquiry, the House amassed powerful evidence of the president's high crimes and misdemeanors. 17 witnesses, 130 hours of testimony combined with the president's own admissions on phone calls and in public comments, confirmed and corroborated by hundreds of texts, emails, and documents. Much of that evidence came from patriotic, nonpartisan, decorated officials in the State Department. They are brave men and women who honored their obligations under the law and gave testimony required by congressional subpoena in the face of the president's taunts and insults. These officials described the president's campaign to induce and pressure Ukraine to announce political investigations, his use of $391 million of vital military aid, taxpayer money appropriated on a bipartisan basis by Congress as leverage to force Ukraine to comply, and his withholding of a meeting desperately sought by the newly elected president of Ukraine. This testimony was particularly compelling because the State Department is at the very center of President Trump's wrongdoing. We heard firsthand from diplomatic officials who saw up close and personal what was happening and who immediately sounded the alarms. Ambassador William Taylor, who returned to Ukraine in June of last year as acting ambassador, texted other State Department officials, "I think it's crazy to withhold security assistance for help with a political campaign." Ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland, who was delegated authority over Ukraine matters by none other than President Trump, testified, "We knew these investigations were important to the president, and we followed the president's orders." And David Holmes, a senior official at the U.S. Embassy in Kyiv, said it was made clear that some action on a Burisma Biden investigation was a condition for an Oval Office meeting. During their testimony, many of these State Department officials described specific documents, including text messages, emails, former diplomatic cables, and notes that would corroborate their testimony and shed additional light on President Trump's corrupt scheme. For instance, Ambassador Taylor, who raised concerns that military aid had been conditioned on the president's demand for political investigations, described a little notebook in which he would take notes on conversations he had with key officials. Ambassador Sondland referred by date and recipient to emails regarding the president's demand that Ukraine announce political investigations. As we'll see through emails that were sent to some of President Trump's top advisors, including acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, Secretary of State Michael Pompeo, and Secretary of Energy Rick Perry. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State George Kent, who oversaw Ukraine policy matters in Washington for the State Department, wrote at least four memos to file to document concerning conduct he witnessed or heard. And Ambassador Kurt Volker, the special representative for Ukraine negotiations, provided evidence that he and other American officials communicated with high-level Ukrainian officials, including President Zelensky himself, via text message and WhatsApp, about the president's improper demands and how Ukrainian officials would respond to them. Based on the testimony we received and on evidence that has since emerged, all of these documents and others that we will describe bear directly on the allegations set forth in the first article of impeachment. They would help complete our understanding of how the president's scheme unfolded in real time. They would support the conclusion that senior Ukrainian officials understood the corrupt nature of President Trump's demand, and they would further expose the extent to which Secretary Pompeo, Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, and other senior Trump administration officials were aware of the president's plot and helped carry it out. We're not talking about a burdensome number of documents. We are talking about a specific, discrete set of materials held by the State Department. Documents the State Department has already collected in response to our subpoena, but has never produced. We know these materials exist. We know they are relevant, and we know the president is desperately trying to conceal them. As I will describe, the Senate should subpoena the following. Number one, WhatsApp and other text message communications. Two, emails. Three, diplomatic cables. And four, notes. Given the significance and relevance of these documents, the House requested that they be provided. When these requests were denied, the House issued subpoenas commanding that the documents be turned over. But at the president's direction, the Department of State unlawfully defied that subpoena. And As I stand here now, the State Department has all these documents in its possession, but refuses, based on the president's order, to let them see the light of day. This is an affront to the House, which has full power to see these documents. It is an affront to the Senate, which has been denied a full record on which to judge the president's guilt or innocence. And it is an affront to the Constitution, which makes clearly that nobody, not even the president, is above the law. And it is an affront to the American people, who have a right to know what the president and his allies are hiding from them and why it is being hidden. In prior impeachment trials, this body has issued subpoenas requiring the recipient to hand over relevant documents. It must do so again here. And it must do so now at the beginning of the trial, not the end. Of course, the need for a Senate subpoena arises because, as I've noted, the president ordered the State Department to defy a subpoena from the House. At this point, I'd like to briefly describe our own efforts to get those materials. I'll then address in a more detailed fashion exactly what documents the State Department has hidden from the American people and why the Senate should require it to turn them over. On September 9th, exercising their Article I oversight authority, the House Investigating Committee sought a document request sent a document request to the State Department. The committee sought materials related to the president's effort to pressure Ukraine to announce investigations into his political rival, as well as his dangerous, unexplained withholding of millions of dollars in vital military aid. After the State Department failed to produce any documents, the House Committee on Foreign Affairs issued a subpoena to the State Department on September 27th. In a letter on October 1st, Secretary Pompeo acknowledged receipt of the subpoena. At that time, he stated that he would respond to the committee's subpoena for documents by the return date, October 4th. But his response never came. Instead, on October 8th, President Trump's lawyer, writing on the president's behalf, issued a direction confirming that the administration would stonewall the impeachment inquiry. To date, the State Department has not produced a single document, not a single document in response to the congressional subpoena. But witnesses who testified indicated that the State Department had gathered all of the records and was prepared to provide them before the White House directed it to defy the subpoena. Notwithstanding this unlawful obstruction through the testimony of brave State Department employees, the House was able to identify with remarkable precision several categories of documents relevant to the first article of impeachment that are sitting right now. Those documents are sitting right now at the State Department. I'd like to walk you through four key categories of documents that should be subpoenaed and which illustrate the highly relevant documents the State Department could produce immediately. They could produce them immediately for this trial. The first category consists of WhatsApps and other text messages from State Department officials caught up in these events, including Ambassadors Sondland and Taylor, and also Deputy Assistant Secretary George Kent, all three of whom confirm in their testimony that they regularly use WhatsApp to communicate with each other and foreign government officials. As Deputy Assistant Secretary Kent explained, WhatsApp is a dominant form of electronic communication in certain parts of the world. We know that the State Department possesses the records of WhatsApp and text messages from critical eyewitnesses to these proceedings, including from Ambassador Sondland and Taylor and Deputy Assistant Secretary Kent. We know that the Department is deliberately concealing these records at the direction of the president, and we know that they could contain highly relevant testimony about the president's plan to condition official presidential acts on the announcements of investigations for his own personal and political gain. We know this not only from testimony, but also because Ambassador Volker was able to provide us with a small but telling selection of his WhatsApp messages. Those records confirm with a full review of these texts and WhatsApp messages from relevant officials would help to paint a vivid, firsthand picture of statements, decisions, concerns, and beliefs held by important players of events unfolding in real time. For example, thanks to Ambassador Volker's messages, we know that Ambassador Sondland, a key player in the president's pressure campaign, who testified in the House about a quid pro quo arrangement, texts directly with the Ukrainian president, President Zelensky. This image produced by Ambassador Volker appears to be a screenshot of a text message that Ambassador Sondland exchanged with President Zelensky about plans for the White House visit, the very same visit that President Zelensky badly needed, and that President Trump later withheld as part of the quid pro quo described by Ambassador Sondland in his testimony. This body and the American people have a right to know what else Ambassador Sondland and President Zelensky said in this and other relevant exchanges about the White House meeting or about the military aid and the president's demand. But we don't know exactly what was conveyed and when. We don't know if President Trump directed the State Department to conceal these vital records. These are records that the State Department would have otherwise turned over if not for the president's direction and desire to cover up his wrongdoing. To get a sense of why texts and WhatsApp messages are so vital, just consider whether another piece of evidence we've gleaned from Ambassador Volker's partial production. On July 10th, at the White House meetings, at which Ambassador Sondland pressured Ukrainian officials to announce investigations of President Trump's political opponents, a Ukrainian governmental official texted Ambassador Volker, "I feel that the key for many things is Rudy, and I am ready to talk with him at any time." This is evidence that immediately following Ambassador Sondland's ultimatum, Ukrainian officials recognized that they needed to appease Rudy Giuliani by carrying out the investigations. Of course, Mr. Giuliani had publicly confirmed that he was not engaged in foreign policy, but it was instead advancing his clients, the president's own personal interest. Further, in another text message exchange provided by Ambassador Volker, we see evidence that Ukraine understood President Trump's demands loud and clear. On the morning of July 25th, half an hour before the infamous call between President Trump and President Zelensky, Ambassador Volker wrote to a senior Ukrainian official, heard from White House, assuming President Z convinces Trump he will investigate, get to the bottom of what happened in 2016, we will nail down date for visit to Washington. Good luck. See you tomorrow. Kurt. Ambassador Sondland confirmed that this text accurately summarized the president's directive to him earlier that morning. After the phone call between President Trump and President Zelensky, the Ukrainian official responded pointedly. Phone call went well. He then discussed potential dates for a White House meeting. Then the very next day, Ambassador Volker wrote to Rudy Giuliani exactly the right messages as we discussed. These messages confirm Mr. Giuliani's central role, the premeditated nature of President Trump's solicitation of political investigation, and the pressure campaign on Ukraine waged by Mr. Giuliani and senior officials at President Trump's direction. Again, this is just some of what we learned from Ambassador Volker's records. As you will see during this trial presentation, there were numerous WhatsApp messages in August, while Ambassadors Volker and Sondland and Mr. Giuliani were pressuring President Zelensky's top aide to issue a statement announcing the investigations that President Trump wanted. And Ambassador Taylor's text that you saw earlier about withholding the aid further reveals how much more material there likely is that relates to the articles of impeachment. There can be no doubt that a full production of relevant texts and WhatsApp messages from other officials involved in Ukraine and in touch with Ukrainian officials, including Ambassador Sondland, Ambassador Taylor, and Deputy Assistant Secretary Kent, would further illuminate the malfeasance addressed in our first article. This leads to the second category of documents that the State Department is unlawfully withholding: emails involving key State Department officials concerning interactions with senior Ukrainian officials and relating to military aid, a White House meeting, and the president's demand for investigations into his rivals. For example, on July 19th, Ambassador Gordon Sondland spoke directly with President Zelensky about the upcoming July 25th call between President Trump and President Zelensky. Ambassador Sondland then sent an email updating key officials about Secretary Pompeo, including Secretary Pompeo, Acting White House Chief of Staff Mel Vaney, and his senior advisor, Robert Blair. In this email, he noted that he prepared President Zelensky, who was willing to make the announcements of political investigations that President Trump desired. Secretary Perry and Mick Mulvaney then responded to Sondland, acknowledging they received the email and recommending to move forward with the phone call that became the July 25 call between the presidents of the United States and Ukraine. We know all of this not because the State Department provided us with critical document, but instead because Ambassador Sondland provided us a reproduction of the email. In his public testimony, Ambassador Sondland quite correctly explained that this email demonstrated, quote, everyone was in the loop.
Everyone was in the loop. It was no secret. Everyone was informed via email on July 19th, days before the presidential call. As I communicated to the team, I told President Zelensky in advance that assurances to run a fully transparent investigation and turn over every stone were necessary in his call with President Trump.
Even viewed alone, this reproduced email is damning. It was sent shortly after Ambassador Sondland personally conveyed the president's demand for investigations to Ukrainians at the White House, leading several officials to sound alarms. It was sent just a few days before the July 25 call, where President Trump asked for a favor. And by itself, this email shows who was embroiled in President Trump's plan to pressure the Ukrainian president for his own political gain. But it's obvious that the full email chain and other related emails to this key time period would also be highly relevant. We don't have those emails because the State Department is hiding them at the direction of the president. The Senate should issue the proposed subpoena to ensure a complete record of these and other relevant emails. Any doubt that the State Department is concealing critical evidence from this body was resolved when the State Department was recently ordered to release documents, including emails pursuant to a lawsuit under the Freedom of Information Act. These documents are heavily redacted and are limited to a very narrow time period. But nevertheless, despite the heavy redactions, these highly limited glimpses into the State Department's secret record demonstrates that those records are full of information relevant to this trial. For example, several of these newly elected or released emails show multiple contacts between the State Department, including Secretary Pompeo and Mr. Giuliani throughout 2019. This is an important fact. Mr. Giuliani served as the president's point person in executing his corrupt scheme. Mr. Giuliani repeatedly emphasized that his role was to advance the president's personal agenda, the president's political interests, not to promote the national security interest of the United States. The fact that the president's private attorney was in contact at key junctures with the Secretary of State, whose senior officials were directed by the president to support Mr. Giuliani's efforts in Ukraine, is relevant, disturbing, and telling. For example, we know that on March 26, as Mr. Giuliani was pursuing the president's private agenda in Ukraine, and just 1 week after The Hill published an article featuring Mr. Giuliani's Ukraine conspiracy theories, Secretary Pompeo and Mr. Giuliani spoke directly on the phone. That same week, President Trump's former personal secretary was asked by Mr. Giuliani's assistant for a direct connection to Secretary Pompeo. Based on these records, it is also clear that Secretary Pompeo was already actively engaged with Mr. Giuliani in early spring of 2019. And it also appears that these efforts were backed by the White House, given the involvement of President Trump's personal secretary. This body and the American people need to see these emails and other files at the State Department, fleshing out these exchanges and the details surrounding Mr. Giuliani's communications with Secretary Pompeo. Moreover, based on call records lawfully obtained by the House from this period, we know that from March 24th to March 30th, Mr. Giuliani called the White House several times and also connected with an unidentified number numerous times. These records show that on March 27th, Mr. Giuliani placed a series of calls to the State Department switchboard. Secretary Pompeo's assistant and the White House switchboard in quick succession, all within less than 30 minutes. Obtaining emails and other documents regarding the State Department's leadership's interaction with President Trump's private lawyer in this period, when Mr. Giuliani was actively orchestrating the pressure campaign in Ukraine related to the sham investigation into Vice President Biden and the 2016 election, would further clarify the president's involvement and direction at this key juncture in the formation of a plot to solicit foreign interference into our election. We also know, based on recently obtained documents, that Les Parmas, an associate of Rudy Giuliani, has assisted him in his representation of President Trump, that Giuliani likely spoke with Secretary Pompeo about Ukraine matters even earlier than previously understood. According to documents obtained from Mr. Parmas, Mr. Giuliani wrote in early February of 2019 that he apparently spoke with Secretary Pompeo about the removal of the U.S. ambassador in Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch. Mr. Giuliani viewed her as an impediment to implementing the president's corrupt scheme and orchestrated a long-running smear campaign against her. Here's what Mr. Parma said about this just last week.
Do you believe that part of the motivation to get rid of Ambassador Yovanovitch, to get her out of post, was because she was in the way of this effort to get the government of Ukraine to announce investigations of Joe Biden?
That was the only motivation.
That was the only motivation.
There's no other motivation.
These are just some of the email communications that we know. These are just some of the email communications that we know to exist, but there are undoubtedly more, including, for example, Ambassador Yovanovitch requests for the State Department to issue a statement of support of her around the time that Mr. Giuliani was speaking directly with Secretary Pompeo. But that statement never came. The State Department has gathered these records and they are ready to be turned over pursuant to a subpoena from the Senate. It would not be a time-consuming or lengthy process to obtain them, and there are clearly important and relevant documents to the president's scheme. If we want the full and complete truth, then we need to see those emails. The Senate should also seek a third item that the State Department has refused to provide, and that's Ambassador Taylor's extraordinary first-person diplomatic cable to Secretary Pompeo, dated August 29, and sent at the recommendation of the National Security Advisor, John Bolton, in which Ambassador Taylor strenuously objected to the withholding of military aid from Ukraine, as Ambassador Taylor recounted in his deposition.
Near the end of Ambassador Bolton's visit, I asked to meet him privately, during which I expressed to him my serious concern about the withholding of military assistance to Ukraine while the Ukrainians were defending their country from Russian aggression. Ambassador Bolton recommended that I send a first-person cable to Secretary Pompeo directly, relaying my concerns. I wrote and transmitted such a cable on August 29th, describing the folly I saw in withholding military aid to Ukraine at a time when hostilities were still active in the East and when Russia was watching closely to gauge the level of American support for the Ukrainian government. The Russians, as I said at my deposition, would love to see the humiliation of President Zelensky at the hands of the Americans. I told the Secretary that I could not and would not defend such a policy. Although I received no specific response, I heard that soon thereafter, the Secretary carried the cable with him to a meeting at the White House focused on security assistance for Ukraine.
While we know from Ambassador Taylor and Deputy Assistant Secretary Kent that the cable was received, we do not know whether or how the State Department responded. Nor do we know if the State Department possesses any other internal records relating to this cable. This cable is vital for three reasons. First, it demonstrates the harm that President Trump did to our national security when he used foreign policy as an instrument of his own personal political gain. Second, on the same day the cable was sent, President Zelensky's senior aide told Ambassador Taylor that he was very concerned about the hold on military assistance. He added that the Ukrainians were just desperate, added to be released. In other words, President Trump's effort to use military aid to apply additional pressure on Ukraine was working. And finally, based on reporting by the New York Times, we now know that within days of Ambassador Taylor sending this cable, President Trump discussed Ukrainian security assistance with Secretary Pompeo, Defense Secretary Esper, and National Security Advisor Bolton. The investigation uncovered testimony that Secretary Pompeo brought Ambassador Taylor's cable to the White House. Perhaps it was during this meeting. There, perhaps prodded by Ambassador Taylor's cable, all three of them pleaded with the president to resume the crucial military aid, yet the president refused. This body has a right to see Ambassador Taylor's cable as well as the other State Department records addressing the official response to it. Although it may have been classified at the time, the State Department could no longer claim that the topic of security assistance remains classified today in light of the president's decision to declassify his two telephone calls with President Zelensky and Mr. Mulvaney's public statements about security assistance. The fourth category of documents that the Senate should subpoena are contemporaneous first-person accounts from State Department officials who were caught up in President Trump's corrupt scheme. These documents, which were described in detail by Deputy Assistant Secretary Kent, Ambassador Taylor, and the political officer David Holmes, would help complete the record and clarify how the president's scheme unfolded in real time and how the Ukrainians reacted. Mr. Kent wrote notes or memos to file at least four times, according to his testimony. Ambassador Taylor took extensive notes of nearly every conversation he had, some in a little notebook. And David Holmes, the embassy official in Ukraine, was a consistent note taker of important meetings with Ukrainian officials.
Did you take notes of this conversation on September 1st with Ambassador Sondland?
I did.
And did you take notes related to most of the conversations, if not all of them, that you recited in your opening statement?
All of them, Mr. Goldman.
And you are aware, I presume, that the State Department has not provided those notes to the committee, is that right?
I am aware.
So we don't have the benefit of reviewing them to ask you these questions?
Correct. I understand that they may be coming sooner or later.
Well, we would welcome that.
The State Department never produced those notes. As another example, Deputy Assistant Secretary Kent testified about a key document that he drafted on August 16th describing his concerns that the Trump administration was attempting to pressure Ukraine into opening politically motivated investigations.
I'd like to start with you, Mr. Kent. In your testimony, you said that you had, in mid-August, it became clear to me that Giuliani's efforts to gin up politically motivated investigations were now infecting U.S. engagement with Ukraine, leveraging President Zelensky's desire for a White House meeting. Mr. Kent, did you actually write a memo documenting your concerns that there was an effort underway to pressure Ukraine to open an investigation to benefit President Trump?
Yes, ma'am. I wrote a memo to the file on August 16th.
But we don't have access to that memo, do we?
I submitted it to the State Department subject to the September 27th subpoena.
And we have not received one piece of paper from the State Department relative to this investigation.
Deputy Assistant Secretary Kent also memorialized a September 15 conversation in which Ambassador Taylor described a Ukrainian official accusing America of hypocrisy for advising President Zelensky against investigating a prior Ukrainian president. Mr. Kent described that conversation during his testimony. He said, but the more awkward part of the conversation came after Special Representative Volker made the point that the Ukrainians, who had opened their authorities under President Zelensky, had opened investigations of former President Poroshenko. He didn't think that was appropriate. And then Andrei Yermak said, what? You mean the type of investigations you're pushing for us to do on Biden and Clinton? The conversation makes clear the Ukrainian officials understood the corrupt nature of President Trump's requests and therefore doubted American credibility on anti-corruption measures. Records of these conversations and other notes and memoranda by senior American officials in Ukraine would flesh out and help complete the record for the first article of impeachment. They would tell the whole truth to the American people and to this body. You should require the State Department to provide them. To summarize, the Senate should issue the subpoena proposed in the amendment requiring the State Department to turn over relevant texts and WhatsApp messages, emails, diplomatic cables, and notes. These documents bear directly on the trial of this body, the trial that this body is required by the Constitution to hold. They are immediately relevant to the first article of impeachment.